Welcome to Living Above the Drama. I'm your host, Dr. Georgiana Donadio, and today my guest is Dr. Nina Shapiro, one of America's leading physicians. Attempting to write a brief introduction about Dr. Shapiro and her many accomplishments in both medicine and beyond has been quite a challenge. She is a Harvard and Cornell-trained surgeon, and she is the director of pediatric otolaryngology and a professor of head and neck surgery at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. She has received numerous prestigious awards throughout her career, and in addition, she's a seasoned and regular guest on The Doctors. She's appeared on The Early Show, CNN, and on NPR radio programming. She's also a regular contributor to the award-winning educational website, Kids in the House, where she is featured in numerous videos on health-related topics from air purifiers to sleep apnea. Her new book, Hype, A Doctor's Guide to Medical Myths, Exaggerated Claims, and Bad Advice, How to Tell What's Real and What's Not, has been published by St. Martin's Press and is available anywhere books are sold. Dr. Nina Shapiro, welcome. I'm so I don't know what to say. You had the longest bio with the most accomplishments. I'm sitting here going, how am I going to do justice to this amazing woman, an amazing doctor? And there's so much I left out, but hopefully throughout the programming, you can shed some more of your wonderful expertise and experience, for us. And welcome. I'm so happy to have you.
Well, thank you. That was an absolutely amazing introduction. I am honored and privileged to be here and to speak with you. So thank you. And it is a real treat for me to have this conversation.
You are most welcome. And believe me, the pleasure is mine. You've written a book about, well, we talked about this in the pre-interview. As I told you, I've been in medicine a long time. And like you, I'm absolutely fascinated with evidence-based information. And I'm the director of the National Institute of Whole Health, which is an evidence-based patient education information training program. It's a continuing education program for nurses and doctors, although we have pharmacists and other people there too. So your passion is kind of like my passion, and so I'm so excited to have you on to talk about this because, yeah, I think today, and this is the age of information. However, as you point out in your book, all information is not created equal. So please tell us how you got involved with this. I did ask you about your background and growing up and all that. You have a wonderful story about how you were raised in this very medical family and how encouraged and inspired you are. So tell us about how you became, and this is a mouthful, of course, an otolaryngologist. I mean, it's like, hello. You have to take a medical language training to pronounce that. But so tell us how you got into, medicine,
right,
and the specialty.
So we
and
work in
else.
Speech and hearing, and it's funny because it's a speech test if you can say it and if you can hear it as well. I guess that's part of our specialty is if you can say what you do. And it is a very, very small field. It's pediatric otolaryngology. So the way I came to get there, once I was, immersed in medicine in medical school, it really sort of came about by a lot of positive mentors, female and male, but it was nice because one of my mentors during medical school was a female otolaryngologist, which was very rare way back in the last millennium, and it was really inspiring to see what I looked at when I was thinking about a specialty was to look at people well into the specialty, not in training and not even 5 years out, but 10, 20, 30 years into their specialty, and if they were still loving what they were doing and passionate about what they were doing, that was really inspiring to me to look ahead and say, I want to do this, and I want to still love it 10, 20, 30 years from now. I really loved surgery. I really loved the anatomy of the head and neck. It's quite unique, quite different from the rest of the body. It has a lot of challenges and nooks and crannies that are these hidden dark corners that were quite interesting. And then I really loved, as I was decided on that field, I loved taking care of families and children and children who have these, whether it's a minor problem or a life-threatening problem, you can do something so small and make such a a huge difference in their life going forward, that it's so satisfying, and it's really a great thing to do.
Right. I read in your book, you tell a story about one little boy who he had to have his adenoids and tonsils out. And, you know, that was like a big deal. And he was suffering in school. He couldn't pay attention. He couldn't sleep. It was really, really bad, you know, for him and his family and his education. And he had a simple surgery. And his life really changed remarkably, and everybody in the family's life changed too.
Right, and that's exactly what you last said, that it's not just, you know, when you're dealing with a child and a family, yes, you have a major impact on the child, but it also can have a major life impact on a family. If, you know, if you, a child had been suffering and you can relieve their suffering, you know, it improves the family as well, which is also really nice.
Oh, absolutely. And as a pediatrician, of course, I mean, when we work with children, we work with the parents.
Exactly. The kids are the easy part, right?
Yeah, they're really, it's like, you know, believe it or not, we actually get veterinarians. Not, we do get veterans, but we get veterinarians who come into our program because they want it for their own information and for the families of their pet parents. And it's amazing. When you're dealing with pets, it's the same thing. You have to take care of the pet parent because it's really the parent that drives it. So much to talk about with you. You came from a medical family. You were excited by medicine. You went into your specialty. You love what you do. You went to Harvard, Cornell. You went to London. You studied at a program in London for your specialty. You've done so many things medically, and you got to be very well known for your work. I guess, you know, it must be very exciting because people call you from all over the world to have you address some of their problems. You also get invited to speak and lecture and be interviewed. So tell us a little bit about, you know, being a celebrity doc, because you're really right up there. It must be, as much fun as it must be also very demanding and take away a little bit from your practice.
It does. And, you know, I live in the town of celebrity. I live in Los Angeles. So we literally have celebrities. And, you know, that's just sort of a, you know, celebrities are people too. They have their own issues, good and bad, and, you know, problems and children. And, you know, that's always a little bit interesting because it always comes with a little bit of social side to it. And, you know, we as doctors need to keep in mind that we're the doctor and they're the patient. And we, you know, we keep that relationship pretty professional. And, you know, I'm also living in the land of extremes where, you know, people have, you know, sort of extreme ideas about health, sometimes for the good and sometimes for the not so good. You know, and I work in a medical center. It's a tertiary medical, so quaternary, we call it medical center, meaning that, you know, we see the sickest of the sick, and, you know, a lot of patients are transferred in from other hospitals or other states or even, you know, other countries with, you know, acute and chronic medical issues, which are quite challenging. But, you know, that's what keeps it interesting and, you know, satisfying, because I have a great team of people at my institution where we work. So it's just, you know, it's never ending. No 2 days are ever the same, and we never know what's going to come up, you know, on a daily basis, and that's what keeps it exciting.
Right. One of the things you talked about, which was very, very interesting, we were talking about how did you get interested in this topic? Because let's face it, the work that you do is not directly connected to writing a book such as, you know, this. So the hype is kind of a little bit of an offshoot of what you do, and you said that there was a lot of information that you, as a physician, as well as your patients, there was confusion. I guess the internet, for all of its good, can also be a breeding ground for misdirection and what I like to call exploratory solutions. You know, what I mean? I think there's an expression, necessity is the mother of invention. And, mm-hmm. you know, what happens is when we can't solve a problem, we start to create. And some of those creations are really excellent, and some of those creations are very faulty. And so what we have now is a plethora of websites with health information. Some of it's good, Some of it's traditional, some of it's not so good, some of it's not traditional and very good. There's a whole range of things that are available. So tell us about kind of like some of the examples of what led you to write this book that you've written.
So, it's true, we are bombarded with information, and much of that information is good. And even the information that may not be pure, as far as evidence-based, there's oftentimes, even with that, there's some grain of kernel of truth in a lot of what we find. But the problem is we are given so much information. It's coming at us most often on our technology, whether it's our computers or our phones, and it's overwhelming. It's overwhelming to people in medicine. It's overwhelming to people not in medicine. And in my practice, even though I have such a specific area of surgery that I do on a daily basis, I still have families that ask me questions, patients that ask me questions, family members of my own that ask me questions, friends, my kids' friends' parents. So it's really, there's so many questions out there, and I found after a while, these are very interesting, important questions, and I really don't have the answers to them. And I really felt that I needed to learn a little bit about why we're so confused, why we're so overwhelmed with this information about our health, but then we as a society are not getting healthier. Why is that we're getting so much information, but we're not really healthier for it? So how can we understand this information, decide what's valuable for our health, how to ignore some information that may just be, sort of fear-mongering or scare tactics to make people worry more, which is certainly not helpful or helpful. So I really started doing more research outside of my field, and it developed into a book. Who knew?
And I guess your book has been well received, and it can be found anywhere if people are looking for it. So the name of the book, again, is Hype, and it has a very long subtitle, which we will repeat. But you want to take a look for the book. And again, Dr. Shapiro has written this to really help dispel a lot of the anxiety and fears and lack of understanding of so much medical information and health information that's out there. Now, during the pre-interview, we talked about specifics, and there are so many specifics we can talk about. In your book, you talk about the risk of surgery, about naked juices, about how linked, how the research, when you read these articles, I talk about how things are linked to research, but not really necessarily, about the AIDS, about the Y2K, about Ebola. You've mentioned a lot of things that address how, things get to be frightening and urgent and kind of in your face in the news, and how all these things kind of take on a life of their own. So apart, and if you want, we can speak about some of those, but apart from that, we really talked about how the American lifestyle today is probably the biggest, culprit in terms of that we are getting sicker. There is more cancer. There's a lot more things going on in our society. And, if we go back to 1985, 1986, 87, 88, and you and I talked about this, I did research on this for a book that I wrote, and you look at the obesity rates. Oh, my God, you just look at the maps, over the last 30 years. It blows your mind. And so we talked about that. So would you mind talking about, you mentioned the racing society that we live in, how we're living in a society where everybody's frantically running around, and we have so many things like traffic congestion, computers, competition, air, water, sleep, lack of rest, all of those things. Do you want to talk about, in your opinion, like how all of that is creating this whirlwind of unhealthiness?
Yeah, I think it all, this, our society, and that's a pretty broad statement as far as whether you live in a city or a small town, but I think it really applies to everyone, no matter what your, for the most part, no matter what your actual living situation, whether it's a city, a suburb, or a small town, is that we are becoming sort of immersed in this stressed environment. We are stressed at work. We are stressed at home. We feel this internal and external pressure that we have to always be achieving and racing and getting to the top, and our kids need to be achieving and racing and getting to the top. And even when we think about relaxing, we put that as an activity. I'm going to relax now as the activity, and I'm doing really good job at relaxing. Even that's becoming a competitive way. I am doing the best stress relief. My stress relief is better than your stress relief. I can prove it. I won a prize. So it's you know, even that has become exhausting, and you know, we've sort of lost sight of the, you know, when I grew up in the, you know, 70s, where you'd go home and you'd play, and, you know, then you'd play some more, and then you'd come in and have dinner and maybe do some homework, and that was the end of your day, and then you go to sleep when your parents tell you go to sleep. It was pretty simple. There was no turn off your iPhone or turn off your technology or get the blue light out of your face, or, you know, be the top of your class when you're 8 years old. You know, it's, you know, our kids are stressed. The obesity in children is now astronomical, and a lot of that is due to inactivity, to, you know, increased traffic, that, you know, kids are spending more time getting to and from school or getting to and from activities. Eating is now not an activity unto itself. It's something we do while we're doing something else. So kids are eating in the car, eating at their sports events. You know, there's sort of that sense of, I did an activity, I now need a treat or a, you know, an award, even if that's in the matter of food. So, you know, so much of the way society is now, we sort of almost forget, although we can think back to how it was a decade or two or three or four ago, and life, you know, it certainly had its stresses, but you know, they were on a much smaller scale, and I think that has really negatively impacted our health, you know, kids and adults.
Absolutely. And during the pre-interview, you were talking about, you know, all these things and how growing up, you know, the kind of healthy family environment that you grew up in. And one of the big things that you mentioned was values. Now, we have to take a commercial break, but when we come back, if you would be kind enough, Dr. Shapiro, to talk to us about values, because isn't this kind of the underpinning of what we're talking about now? You know, how we as a culture, as a society, by and large, how we value our time, our lives, our behaviors. So when we come back, don't go anywhere, listeners. We are coming back with Dr. Nina Shapiro, who has written a wonderful book called Hype, which will give you lots of information to questions that you want answered. But we are with her today live, and we're going to get this right from the horse's mouth. We'll be right back.
Are you tired of not feeling heard and not feeling valued? Are you longing to receive the love and respect you want? There is a solution right now. Transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills. Dr. Georgiana Donadio, relationship communication expert and number one national best-selling, award-winning author of Changing Behavior, explores the unconscious patterns contributing to stress, lack of fulfillment, and our relationship interactions. By learning and applying the simple principles of behavioral engagement, which has been clinically tested in leading hospitals, to develop mindful pure presence, you can experience the happiness and fulfillment you deserve in your relationships. Begin changing your behavior today with Living Above the Drama radio show host, Dr. Georgiana Donadio. Call 888-354-4325. 888-354-HEAL. Call now.
Become credentialed for the emerging medical health and wellness field. Work within healthcare environments or start your own private practice and bill for your services with your own NPI number. Train for this exciting specialty in patient-focused health and wellness education with the National Institute of Whole Health, NIWH, the only nationally accredited training program for patient health education and advocacy. Open to credentialed health and education professionals, our training qualifies for health educator liability insurance, a national provider identification number, and our expert-prepared billing and coding manual.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health, visit www.niwh.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL.
888-354-4325.
If someone said you could transform your life and enhance your relationships by using a few simple communication techniques that can be applied in almost any setting, would you want to learn these skills? If the answer is yes, you've picked up the right book. This easy-to-read guide is loaded with simple skills that have been scientifically shown to have a huge impact on our relationships. By using the steps in this book, you will be able to enhance not only your life, but the lives of everyone around you. If you have the intention to practice and apply these skills, it will become a natural part of who you are. A true must-read for anyone who wants to transform their professional and personal lives. Changing behavior. Immediately transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills by Georgiana Donadio.
You can purchase Changing Behavior by Dr. Georgiana Donadio by visiting Amazon.com, where it is available in both Kindle ebook and paperback.
Dr. Gass is on the advisory board of HealthCorp, a new program which was begun by Dr. Mehmet Oz.
65% are overweight and 35% are obese, and the sharpest rise in this country is between the age group of 4 to 8 years old.
Throughout his career, he has been inspired by patients who have experienced dramatic recoveries through lifestyle changes.
The National Institute of Whole Health is a perfect example of how people will learn to really take control of their lives in a healthy way.
What they've done is they've collected basically the who's who of integrative health, and they've brought them together to give a series of lectures where they can then communicate with health professionals to basically deliver the message that we have to look at medicine from a different perspective.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health and their accredited professional continuing educational programs, go to www.wholepersonhealthcare.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL.
And we are back with Dr. Nina Shapiro, the author of a new book called Hype, and a medical expert with lots and lots of credentials and information to share with us so that we can be better consumers and hopefully live a happier, healthier, calmer, and a more productive, in a healthy way, life. Before the break, Dr. Shapiro, we were talking about values, and when you were describing your childhood and how you grew up and about balance and about, you know, having a sense of, you know, kind of a healthy relationship to the various components, and it's the same way you're raising your children now. Can you talk to us about that? Because it seems that we are an anxiety-ridden culture. Our values have shifted tremendously. And this seems to be contributing so much to what you were just saying about why we have the kind of statistics that we have.
Yes, you know, I grew up in a suburb of New York, and you know, we had what I think, and even looking back now, pretty good balanced values. We had, you know, obviously we were, you know, had a put a lot of value on education and health and nutrition and exercise and having balance in our lives that way. But we also, you know, I remember growing up that I didn't have every second of my childhood scheduled. I didn't have an event every hour. I didn't have a designated rest time or, you know, activity-free time. It was a little more free-flowing. And I try to, and it's really, you know, it's hard. I have two kids who are very busy. They're, you know, elementary, middle school, high school, roughly ages. And you know, they are very scheduled. And we really, as a family, try to have not everything done to achieve a certain outcome. For instance, recently, one of my kids asked, you know, which elective should I do next year? And as opposed to saying, well, you know, which one is going to get you into the best school going forward or which one is going to give you the highest achievement, you know, I asked the question, well, which one do you think you would enjoy more? And people sort of have lost that sense of just doing something because you enjoy it.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
even, you know, and these are young kids where, you know, not everything has to be done for the outcome of the next step or achieving a certain level of expertise or you know, achievement award. It, you know, that people have lost so much of that sense of just doing something because you enjoy it, or not doing something because you enjoy not doing something for a bit of time without necessarily having to schedule it in. So I really try to, you know, continue that with my own family, that, you know, some things should just be done because you need to relax for however much time, or you need to, you know, do something because you like it, not because you're going to get, you know, a trophy at the end. And I think, you know, that you know, will hopefully lead them to love what they do and to choose what they want to do because they love it. And I think that's how people thrive in their adult life, is if they can choose something that they really, you know, they sort of the saying, you know, if I love what I work, I love my work, which makes it not work.
Exactly.
You know, that sort of idea that, you know, if you really are passionate about something, you will, you know, continue it and be, you know, happy and actually successful. The success should come from loving what you do.
Right. And even the hobbies today and the activities today, it's like, well, this will be on your resume to get into school, and, well, that will lead you to network with the right people.
Right,
and
right.
Even, yeah, the things that our children are doing, as you say, you know, there's no leisure time. I was watching the movie Beauty and the Beast. Love the movie. And the father of Belle, of course, and he's sitting there and loving what he's doing and relaxing, and just, you can just see that, you know, people can and did enjoy the things they did for a living, and the things, like you say, like the, you know, a lot of the artisans and the craftsmen and the people who created beautiful things, and so many times now those things, like if somebody said, well, I want to be a jewelry maker, I want to be an artisan, people would look at them and go, what are you kidding? What kind of money?
Right.
You know,
mm-hmm.
It's like everything is about that. And what about the idea that our population has doubled since 1985?
Right.
Do you think that's a big factor in the competitiveness and the pressure and the anxiety that we're living with?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, our cities are crowded, and you can see, you know, if anyone who's lived in one particular place, whether it's a small or big town or a city, you've seen the increased congestion in traffic, in schools, in, you know, and that will breed competition for spaces and for you know, for everything, for just getting, you know, across town becomes a competitive endeavor. So I think the population, you know, we have a finite amount of space in this world, and, you know, it's crowded, and people tend to gravitate towards certain areas. So certain areas are becoming even more congested than other areas, and that, you know, adds to all of the other stresses of congestion of people and cars and spaces, and obviously then that comes the pollution, and, you know, that goes with all of the increased ways of getting around. So you know, certainly that has added to our stress.
Absolutely. So we need to be mindful that a lot of this is common sense, and it's a good idea if you live in the city to get out of there once in a while.
Right, if you can,
Yeah, and it's a good idea to be aware of your environment in terms of noise and rest and all those things. Let's talk about some subjects that you particularly addressed in your book, because one of the things I think is a biggie, because I know for children, of course, but even for adults, the discussion about surgery, that is such a big thing. And I think especially in older populations today, in our country, the idea of going under the knife is not good. And the idea of the anesthesiology, and, you know, because all of us, at least once or twice a year, we hear about somebody who went in for a routine operation and never woke up.
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk to us about, you know, that's a hype. We hear it all the time. It's something that people talk about at the water cooler. Let's talk about the reality of surgery and anesthesia and risk.
So risk is very, actually that was my favorite chapter to work on, was the risk chapter, because it is so interesting how people perceive risk and as opposed to what is the real risk. So there is no surgery that is without risk. There is no anesthesia that is without risk. However, the question becomes, you know, how does the risk benefit ratio, or what is the benefit over the risk of surgery? So certainly when we're talking about an elective surgery, and that's a little bit of a tricky word. So elective really could mean anything from not an emergency, like you need a, you know,
appendectomy.
Appendectomy I would say is more of an urgent surgery. So
you know
your knee has been bothering you, and you need, you know, and if you have a knee surgery, you know, that may help with your knee pain. That could be considered elective, because if you know, it's not a life and death situation. You don't have acute appendicitis, or, you know, an acute heart problem, or, you know, a bleed in your, you know, some sort of emergency, you know, situation. We always talk about weighing the benefits of the risk. What is the risk of surgery versus the risk of not doing surgery? And for certain disorders, the risk of not doing surgery is much higher than the risk of doing surgery.
Like a heart valve replacement, that's
exactly.
Pretty urgent.
It's a risky surgery, but the risk of not doing surgery is much higher. Or, you know, appendicitis, that's a little bit trickier, because nowadays we're actually treating appendicitis more and more with antibiotics, finding that a lot of people end up not needing their appendix out. But, you know, not too long ago, appendectomy was the treatment for acute appendicitis, because of the risk of the appendix bursting or rupturing, and that can cause a very serious life-threatening infection. But, you know, the other thing that people sort of put out of perspective is, what was the risk of your getting to the hospital, driving in your car? And what are the risks of traffic accidents over the risks of doing surgery? And people don't really think about that. You know, we think about the extreme, you know, the thing you hear about in the news. You're going to hear about some horrible, devastating event that somebody had a, you know, quote-unquote minor surgery and never left the hospital. Those are horrible, horrible events, and we as surgeons do take those very seriously. But you don't, you know, what's not going to make the news is the hundreds of thousands of people who did fine with the surgery and left. That's not a headline. The headline is going to be the one horrific negative thing that happened. You're not going to hear a headline news about, oh, a child went to the hospital, had surgery, and came home.
Right, exactly.
And did great. That's not going to make headlines.
Good news doesn't sell. Right?
No, good news doesn't sell. That's right, but bad news travels fast.
But tell us about the improvements of anesthesiology and the improvements that have actually helped to lower the mortality rate after surgery.
So one of the biggest improvements in surgery has actually been the improvement in anesthesia. So we surgeons like, of course, to take credit for all of the improvements, but it's actually the anesthesiologist that should take most of the credit. And especially anesthesia and surgery for children, the anesthesia has become so much safer in the last decade or so compared to how it was, you know, years back. We have new anesthetic agents where we, you know, don't use narcotics, you know, opioids, where we can really minimize or avoid use of that and use other safer anesthetics. We have very short-acting anesthetics, especially for children, so they don't, you know, I do some surgeries that literally take, you know, 3 or 4 minutes to do, and, you know, that afternoon the kid is at the playground because the anesthesia is completely gone from their system within an hour or so. So, you know, anesthesia has become so much safer. The risks of allergies to anesthesia or bad reactions to anesthesia are extremely low. And then also a lot of the surgeries that we do, even, you know, heart surgeries, valve surgeries, become, you know, what we like to call minimally invasive. So, you know, either where it's no incision or, you know, you go home the same day. People sometimes have, you know, hip replacements and they'll go home the same day or the next morning. You know, that was unheard of years ago.
Right. Now there's even a balloon, procedure for heart valve replacement, which is hard to believe.
It's incredible. Yeah. People have, quote-unquote, heart surgery, but they don't have that typical, you know, opening up the chest scar anymore. They just have a little catheter, and that's it. And even, you know, for those heart procedures, sometimes, you know, patients go home the same day or the next day, which is amazing.
It really is something. So I think the overview on that is that technology has improved, although there's no guarantee, and everything has a risk to it. The technology, the anesthesia, the surgical procedure, the length of time. What could you possibly do that takes 3 minutes or 4 minutes to do surgically? I need to hear this. Is this an ingrown toenail? What is that?
Ear tubes, which are the most common
tube,
surgery
course,
in the country.
Course. Right,
yes.
right, of course.
They take
course.
A minute and a half, maybe two.
Oh, wow.
And really, the child is asleep just for that long, maybe 3-4 minutes. So it's that is one of the best. My favorite operation, because a child comes in and they can't hear, and they go home and they hear, and it's in minimal pain. They don't have any medications. We don't even need to start an intravenous. It's just a little mask that they breathe. Go off to sleep. Go home. Go to school the next day. It's great. So there are surgeries like that. So and that's pretty nice. And again, their drive to the hospital is riskier than the surgery in that.
Wow,
case.
isn't that something? So
especially in Los Angeles.
So listeners, what Dr. Shapiro has just told us, that talk to your doctor and your anesthesiologist and ask the questions. What's the latest, the greatest anesthesia that I can get? And talk to your surgeon and find out what's new and what can be done to really help you in the least invasive way, because there's a whole lot of new technology, and that's quite wonderful. I love the conversation in the book about naked juice. I have to tell you that this because, in addition to some of the things I do, I became a nutritionist many decades ago. And one of the things I've always believed, like you do, is like, why are people drinking all this juice? I mean, you couldn't eat that much fruit without getting really sick. The sugar content, there's so many aspects to juices. You want to talk about that? Because mothers are running around, pumping juices into their kids like there's no tomorrow. And it's still a big overload, isn't it?
Juicing has become, the rage in adults, and it's now, the term juicing is, equivalent to something healthful. But actually, juice, and, I indulge, I talk about the my drinking the juice, after a tough day in the OR. But, I know that it's not healthy for me. I know that it's not a good thing. It's a treat, and it's really just like a sugar syrup that I'm drinking. And, we as humans have teeth. And the digestive system for a reason. We have internal juicers, and you don't have to pulverize your food unless you can't eat or eat appropriately. And one of the things that you lose in juicing, whether it's a fruit or a vegetable, is the most significant benefit of those foods is the fiber. And if you pulverize it down or blend it down to a liquid, the fiber gets destroyed, and it concentrates the sugar, and it tastes great, but it's less healthy than just eating, a piece of fruit or a vegetable.
Right.
And people have this notion that if you juice down your kale, and you can juice down this huge bag of kale into a 4-ounce drink and get all this extra vitamins. You don't need those extra vitamins. You can just eat eat some kale, and that's really, really healthy for you. And the majority of the health benefit is the fiber and a little bit of the vitamins. But you don't need to.
Worse than that, the juicing oxidizes the nutrients. So rather than getting all those nutrients, you're actually oxidizing them.
You lose a lot of it as well.
Right, exactly. Now, I'm on the same page with you about that, and I think that part of the problem is, and we talked about this too, the whole idea that more is better, the whole idea that moderation, we really have a problem with moderation. We think, well, if you should eat one apple a day, what would it be to drink 4 apples a day? And it's kind of like, is this really kind of crazy notion that we have? Yeah, a lot of things get fad. There's a lot of fads going on out there, as you well know. And you had mentioned in the book, like the words in the news when they're talking about research, is that things have been linked and things are associated with, like this food or that, vitamin or something is related to something else. And I'm not going to put down some of the fabulous, legitimate research that's been done on nutrition, because as you and I talked about, 35 years ago, when you talked about folic acid in pregnant women, they called you a quack. Today, folic acid is part of the protocol for, you know, prenatal vitamins. So there's some really good research going on, and I'm sure more and more of it will start to sort out what is good and what is bad. But talk about this, you know, the way research is pitched and the way it's presented.
Right, so exactly what you said, is research pitched? And, you know, you can find, you know, have a very small study, you know, with a very interesting finding, and it's purely just interesting, but if you pitch it the right way, it can all of it, you know, it could be headline news. You know, this vitamin is associated with better X, Y, or Z, and that's very enticing, and, you know, but it can be quite misleading. And, you know, the thing about research is, you know, as you said, you know, we learned about folic acid and how it can minimize problems, you know, with the baby, and that's why pregnant women need to take it to prevent these problems. And, you know, that's why we continue as, you know, scientists, doctors, researchers to do research, because we do find information changes. And people, you know, and it's very frustrating for a lot of people, rightly so. Wait a second, you said this was good for us. Now you're saying it's bad for us. Which
mm-hmm.
is it?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we can only do what we learn and give the information, knowing, and, you know, unfortunately, knowing that we may have different information with the next study that goes on. You know, one example was, you know, the American Heart Association was promoting coconut oil as heart healthy until some more data came out and said, wait, no, we meant it's not healthy.
I hear you, and I never got on that coconut oil kick, and intuitively, and this is something that we are forgetting. We're forgetting intuition. We're forgetting what feels right for our body. We're forgetting a lot of things that are kind of germane to our particular experience. We talked in the pre-interview about the kosher dietary laws, which are 5,000, 6,000 years old, and yet that was an observation that became a practice, and research is really observation. So when you have very traditional eating styles, such as kosher dietary eating, which is really incredibly intelligent when you look at
mm-hmm.
it, and it's been proven in the laboratory that it's very efficacious, and there are other cultures and other things around the world that also prove to be very appropriate, we need to be kind of more in touch with what is common sense and what makes sense for us and our lifestyle. Now, hard to believe, but the last segment, we've got 10 minutes left. We're going to take a short commercial break. We're going to come back. When we come back, let's talk about some of the fun fads. Like, I'm sure you've heard this, milk causes mucus. I mean, I've heard that for 40 years in my nutrition practice, but we'll talk about that when we come back. Don't go anywhere. Dr. Shapiro is going to share some goodies with us. We're going to maybe talk about AIDS and Y2K and some of the other fun things and how information can really be a little distorted, and we want to get wise to that. So we'll be right back. Don't go anywhere.
Dr. Gass is on the advisory board of HealthCorp, a new program which was begun by Dr. Mehmet Oz.
65% are overweight and 35% are obese, and the sharpest rise in this country is between the age group of 4 to 8 years old.
Throughout his career, he has been inspired by patients who have experienced dramatic recoveries through lifestyle changes.
The National Institute of Whole Health is a perfect example of how people will learn to really take control of their lives in a healthy way. What they've done is they've collected basically the who's who of integrative health, and they've brought them together to give a series of lectures where they can then communicate with health professionals to basically deliver the message that we have to look at medicine from a different perspective.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health and their accredited professional continuing educational programs, go to www.wholepersonhealthcare.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL.
If someone said you could transform your life and enhance your relationships by using a few simple communication techniques that can be applied in almost any setting, would you want to learn these skills? If the answer is yes, you've picked up the right book. This easy-to-read guide is loaded with simple skills that have been scientifically shown to have a huge impact on our relationships. By using the steps in this book, you will be able to enhance not only your life, but the lives of everyone around you. If you have the intention to practice and apply these skills, it will become a natural part of who you are. A true must-read for anyone who wants to transform their professional and personal lives. Changing Behavior. Immediately transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills by Georgiana Donadio.
You can purchase Changing Behavior by Dr. Georgiana Donadio by visiting Amazon.com, where it is available in both Kindle ebook and paperback.
Are you tired of not feeling heard and not feeling valued? Are you longing to receive the love and respect you want? There is a solution right now. Transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills. Dr. Georgiana Donadio, relationship communication expert and number one national best-selling, award-winning author of Changing Behavior, explores the unconscious patterns contributing to stress, lack of fulfillment, and our relationship interactions. By learning and applying the simple principles of behavioral engagement, which has been clinically tested in leading hospitals, to develop mindful pure presence, you can experience the happiness and fulfillment you deserve in your relationships. Begin changing your behavior today with Living Above the Drama radio show host, Dr. Georgiana Donadio. Call 888-354-4325. 888-354-HEAL. Call now.
Become credentialed for the emerging medical health and wellness field. Work within healthcare environments or start your own private practice and bill for your services with your own NPI number. Train for this exciting specialty in patient-focused health and wellness education with the National Institute of Whole Health, NIWH, the only nationally accredited training program for patient health education and advocacy. Open to credentialed health and education professionals, our training qualifies for health educator liability insurance, a national provider identification number, and our expert-prepared billing and coding manual.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health, visit www.niwh.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL, 888-354-4325.
We are back with Dr. Nina Shapiro, who is an outstanding medical physician and expert and media expert, talking about many different aspects of health, especially pediatric health. And she has written a wonderful book that we would invite all of you to read, because I personally, I did not get to read the whole book, but I went through the book in preparation for the show. And there are such fun topics in there, stuff I think that, especially if you're a parent, you're going to find very interesting. Her book is Hype, A Doctor's Guide to Medical Myths, Exaggerated Claims, and Bad Advice, How to Tell What's Real and What's Not. Dr. Shapiro, before the break, we talked about coming back and exploring some of these fun things. I know in my nutrition practice, I have heard for decades people saying, oh, milk causes mucus. It makes mucus in your body. We have to explain, no. You see, if you're allergic to milk, which some people are, if you have a milk allergy, that allergy will irritate your mucous membranes potentially and can produce mucus, but milk does not equate mucus. And aren't there a lot of those fun things that are kicking around, huh?
There are, and I get, you know, and people say them with such conviction, and, you know, they get a little upset if I say, oh, you know, your child can have ice cream after I take their tonsils out and it will not destroy them. And the kid loves it. The parent's a little upset. It's, you know, milk is a biggie. And I think, you know, the one thing about milk is that if you have a baby, an infant, and they have a bottle in their crib and they're lying flat and drinking milk, you know, that's not the best thing. That can leave a little bit of residue and coating, but it's not going to cause colds or cause ear infections or cause bronchitis or anything, or cause an actual illness unless you have a real milk intolerance or dairy intolerance or true allergy. So people, you know, tend to vilify a lot of foods thinking that they are causing a lot of problems, which they're not.
Right. Well, let's talk about ear infections. Now, you were just talking about the tubes. Oh, my goodness, there was a period of time where every single child I knew was being rushed in to put tubes in their ears. Why is it that the immune systems of children today, that the resilience is so lowered that there's unprecedented, at least there was for that period of time, unprecedented amount of ear infections, because it is an immunological, part of that whole protective system. Can you talk to us about that? I know the listeners want to hear about this.
An ear problem is the most common reason a child is brought to a doctor, period. So ear infections are, you know, just the most common thing that we see as pediatric specialists or even just, you know, general pediatricians. That's the most common thing that they see. And there's several factors that have played into why it's so common. One is that, antibiotics became, the rage a few decades ago, and everyone was put on, you know, not just these basic antibiotics that I grew up with, but, you know, much more high-level antibiotics and, you know, specific antibiotics and stronger antibiotics, and we've developed a society resistant to antibiotics. So a lot of ear infections don't respond to the antibiotics that we were using years ago, and now kids are needing antibiotic shots. They're needing adult dose antibiotics to cure ear infections. So, you know, part of the problem is that the antibiotics aren't working anymore. And, you know, that's definitely a big issue. And then, you know, when I was talking about tubes as this great surgery, and I love to do it, there were some really great studies showing that tubes were being overdone and not necessary as much as we had thought. And so, you know, that was a huge study and a great study done at a large center. And, you know, but the caveat is that it's not saying that tubes shouldn't be done at all, but that perhaps it's reasonable to wait. And, you know, and with a lot of medical issues, ear infections included, we're learning that we don't necessarily need to jump on antibiotics or jump on surgery, that sometimes we're not giving kids the chance to see if they can get better on their own. We've kind of lost that. You know, it's part of this whole societal, let's, you know, quick fix and get to the answer and fix the problem. Well, maybe the child can just get, you know, maybe their infection will just go away. What a concept. And, you know, they don't need to be pumped with antibiotics, you know, every time they have, you know, a cold or fluid behind their ears. So, you know, that's part of the reason why we've seen such a rise in ear infections, is that they're sort of being overtreated and, you know, too aggressive on, you know, treatment, whether it's medical or surgical.
Right, and you refer to that as the watchful waiting approach. So rather than jumping in, there's a bit of watchful waiting, and that can run across the, you know, all the boundaries, whether it's, something small or whether it's something large. Also, when we were talking at the pre-interview, you had mentioned, and I got a kick out of this because it's such a great example, the Y2K panic. You talked about the panic, you know, like we in America, you know, we get very panicked about everything, you know. The news comes on and we're, you know, in a state of upset. You want to talk about things like Y2K panic, the flu epidemics, AIDS, of course, AIDS was a very serious thing, but just the fear that we often generate with this misinformation about what's actually going on.
Right. So we do, you know, we talked about this. We do panic really well in this country, and we have a little bit of, you know, we kind of thrive on that. And most of us who are over the age of 30 or so can remember where we were on December 31st, 1999, and not only where we were, but what we did to prepare. Some of us did, you know, a little bit. Some of us did major, major preparation for this day, expecting everything to crash and the banks to, you know, have no more cash and you know, no more electricity, and our computers would crash and our food would become, you know, we'd have no more food supply. And so everyone did this extreme preparation. And then nothing happened. It was just a regular New Year's. And people were, as opposed to relieved, people were a little bit disappointed because they were kind of, they wanted to kind of live through this crazy movie that would be produced about Y2K. And then when nothing happened, it was a little bit of a disappointment. And then, you know, and then people lose sight of what really can be a problem, what we should really be thinking about, you know, for instance, that winter of 2000 was one of the biggest flu epidemics because people weren't thinking about preventing the flu. They were thinking about Y2K. So we lost sight of that. And, you know, I also talk about Ebola, which is a horrible, devastating virus that, you know, hit this country a few years back. And Ebola was the rage. And, you know, but again, you know, people were panicked about Ebola, but they maybe forget to put their seatbelt on or text and drive and, you know, forget about the real day-to-day, you know, quote-unquote mundane risks, but think about these wild risks that are so extraordinary and captivating, but we lose sight of just, you know, the basic, you know, taking care of ourselves and being safe and healthy.
Right, and don't you think a lot of that has to do with the incredible cultural anxiety that we're all living in? And the question, like, I remember a couple of years ago, I was writing for the Huffington Post, and I wrote an article about the reason people are poised at their cell phones and waiting for that next email and that next text to come in. It's as if everyone, not everyone, but so many of us are waiting to either be recognized, to be validated, to be acknowledged, accepted, chosen, loved. It's as if, you know, it's a cliffhanger. What is everybody waiting for?
That's a question. I wish I knew. I hope I get it. No. I think that, you know, it's true. People are sort of, you know, you post something on a social media site, and then you get extremely disappointed if you don't get enough clicks or likes, or, you know, people are really thriving on that, you know, so-called validation, and, you know, people can't, unfortunately, we're relying so externally that we can't just, you know, feel enjoyment for what we're doing just for the sake of it.
Exactly.
It's a real problem. There's actually, you know, the term nomophobe, which is becoming a real psychiatric term, you know, for people who are addicted to their cell phones.
Oh, yeah.
And you're never going to be satisfied. I think that, you know, I think what people find, if they really think about it, you know, what's the magic number of likes that you can get, or the number of, you know, people, you know, pretty much strangers acknowledging your being is, you know, it really leads to, you know, just more dissatisfaction with oneself, as opposed to really looking internally and saying, oh, I'm happy with what I'm doing and I feel good about it.
Exactly.
That's, unfortunately, for most of people, it's not enough anymore.
Absolutely. I want to close with this quote from Dr. James Hillman, who's a very renowned radical new psychologist. He wrote many years ago, but it's still true. People are itchy and lost and bored and quick to jump to any fix, including, you know, bad medical information. Why is there such a vast self-help industry in this country? Why do all these selves need help? They have been deprived of something by our psychological culture. They have been deprived of the sense that there is something else in life, some purpose that has come with them into the world. The conversation we've had today has been so wonderful, and you are just such a breath of fresh air as a medical physician and as a person to really bring some, what I like to think of as, common sense to the dialogue. We want to promote your book. Remember, everyone, this book is available wherever you can find books, and the name of it is Hype, A Doctor's Guide to Medical Myths, Exaggerated Claims, and Bad Advice, How to Tell What's Real and What's Not. And Dr. Doctor, your website, please, if we can have that address for our listeners.
Well, thank you again. It's been such a pleasure. This conversation has been excellent, and I really enjoyed it. And my website is www.drninashapiro.com. So it's
and
Dr.
it's N-I-N-A Shapiro, right?
Correct.
It's Dr. Yeah, because, you know, I actually would pronounce the name Nina sometimes.
That's and, East Coast. That's right. A lot of East Coast is Nina. I remember
That's
that.
That's right. That's right. So it's DrNinashapiro. Thank you so much. Much luck with the book. Thank you for coming on. And the wonderful, bless you for the wonderful work that you do on behalf of all of us, especially the children whose lives you make such a big difference with.
Thank you. So nice.
And listeners, don't go away. No, see, I'm used to saying that with a commercial. Don't forget to come back next week when we have yet another inspiring and really uplifting story on living above the drama.